Baseball fans, BetMGM is giving you the chance to win a prize every day during the baseball season. Step into the batter's box for BetMGM's Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. Pick any area of the strike zone and take your best swing. If you get a single, double, triple, or home run, you'll receive a prize. Smash a home run to collect a bonus bet on us. Just log into your BetMGM Sports account to get started. Then visit your promotion section to access the Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. You'll score a prize if you hit a single, double, triple, or home run. There's nothing more exciting than going yard, so swing for the fences with the king of sportsbooks. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. Must be 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards vary depending on the market and expire 24 hours from issuance. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Prime Day es el 16 y 17 de julio. Con las ofertas épicas exclusivas para miembros Prime, recibe el reconocimiento que tanto mereces.
¡Wow! Gracias. Ni siquiera preparé un discurso.
Quisiera agradecer a mi familia, que siempre necesita cosas. También a Sam, mi repartidor, por entregarme todas mis ofertas increíbles tan rápido. ¡Te adoro, Sam! ¡Mua!
Compra ofertas en electrónicos, hogar y más este Prime Day, del 16 al 17 de julio.
Hey everyone, it's Yasir, and I'm calling today with a little favor to ask. Over the recent weeks and months, I've had loads of you get in touch with some great questions, and today I'm going to be trying something new with the show. I'm trialing a Q&A segment where I'll be joined by co-host and elite coach educator, Gerard Jones. Now, these are discussions which are going to be taking place every Sunday evening at 7:30 GMT, live on Twitter Space, if you wanted to get involved directly. Otherwise, I'll be releasing them here every Wednesday on the Coaches Network podcast. So for today's format, slightly different, and for around about 30 minutes, each discussion will be dedicated to a question that has been sent in, where myself and Gerard will be going into some real depth and sharing our views and opinions on the topic in order to leave you with some key takeaways to consider in your own environments. So the favour I'm asking for today, guys, is if you could let me know your thoughts on the new format, and you can do this by getting in touch on Twitter at TheCoachesNet. Once again, that is at TheCoachesNet. And of course, if you have a question, feel free to send that in too. Hope you enjoy the new format.
The Coaches Network, bringing the game together.
Hey guys, you're now listening to the Coaches Network podcast, a podcast aimed at anyone who's passionate about athlete, talent, and personal development. My name's Coach Yas, and I'm a UEFA A-licensed football coach, coach developer, and content creator. I'll be sitting down with a range of guests to discuss their journeys, their life lessons, and how you can make an impact. Enjoy. So Jared, conscious, obviously, we've had a bit of a break, so maybe just, you know, revisit the fact that, you know, this is going to be a part of a series of spaces around a 1v1 approach, a 360-degree 1v1 approach, rather. Key takeaways for you so far, and then we'll deep dive into tonight's topic.
Yeah, I would say just a lot of emphasis around the importance of 1v1s, really. And, you know, previous conversations, we've talked about what are some of the different ways that you can develop this within a curriculum or within your own environment. The importance of duels. So trying to think of different ways that you can create little 1v1 duels and games within your environments. And then ultimately, you know, often when we talk about this, we looked at it from a lens of with the ball and in possession, but actually what about out of possession? So those are like real key nuggets that we sort of unpacked in previous episodes, and, you know, excited to go further.
Awesome. Probably couldn't have said it any better myself. Similar takeaways for me in terms of what we looked at. So I guess deep diving into today's topic then, the intention of 1v1, where does your mind go to straight away with it? Yeah, let's start with that and we'll go from there.
Well, my first thing is, ultimately, you want to keep the ball. But there's probably different layers here. Where my head always goes is the intention of a 1v1. I probably think, first of all, in possession. Although I know we talked about that, out of possession, defending 1v1, it's equally as important. But I probably would think about, okay, what's the intentionality behind trying to move the ball forward, trying to advance the ball forward in a 1v1 duel, and then obviously not losing possession in a turnover, because often, and this is probably one of the reasons why 1v1 is so important, if players are losing possession and it's breaking down individually, technically, then there's a reason for that. And I think that's probably another reason why a lot of the environments that we create should be these games within games, where we're creating this heightened level of competition and duels within the practice. We're thinking about the matchups. We're thinking about clever ways to develop players to be better at the 1v1 tactics, individual tactics. Because ultimately, when they're in a game situation, they're under pressure, can they outplay the opponent? So my initial thinking would be, you know, several layers, but one would be not losing possession. Can we find ways to advance the ball forward, whether that be to dribble, drive with it, stay on the ball, or to go forward, pass around an opponent? And then I would also think about, how do I engage an opponent 1v1? You know, that's where my initial head goes. But again, what's your thoughts on that, Yaz?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a lot in there. And I think first and foremost, I think, you know, I like the fact that obviously we've clarified that, you know, for all intents and purposes, you've started off with the in possession piece, but out of position is just as important, right? I think in your own way, you've probably kind of summarized it how I would do it. And it's effectively, if we're looking at it in possession, fundamentally, you know, you've got a couple of different roles here, right? It's linking into the overall principles of play and how we want teams to maybe progress the ball up the pitch. Obviously, there's just, you know, three ways in which we do that. We either go through, around, over the team. Okay, brilliant. So if we're going through, around, over the team, what's the purpose of those things? Bringing it back to the 1v1 is, well, am I effectively finishing the attack? Am I building the attacks? Or am I creating the attack, all right, in that respect? So in which case, you know, we've spoken about this in the past as well around, well, I've certainly spoken about in terms of, you know, pairing of components, right? Technical components in the game and how they play a part. So in terms of the intention, well, the intention of the 1v1 is in many respects going to be dictated by the technical components involved, and or rather the intention is going to dictate the technical components involved, but the perception of the players is going to dictate what the intentions could be. So you might be in the defending third and you might find an opportunity to create an attack in the final third with that ball in the defending third, in which case you're probably looking for a dribble, for a lofted pass maybe of some sort, or it might be some sort of pairing, but fundamentally the technical components are never standalone. They're always going to be in twos of some sort. And then I think from it, I guess looking at it from a deeper lens, it's in the intention of the 1v1. Well, my mind goes to the viewpoint of how do we coach, or how do we get the players to better understand and observe and assess what's in front of them in that situation, which then might inform their decision of what to do with it. I.e., you know, we're always talking about players being able to see things and scan for things and look at things, but actually, how well do we teach them what to look out for and what to see as a fundamental cue or a trigger in their decision-making processes, especially in a 1v1 situation? And I've written this down earlier when I was thinking about it. Where is it? There we go. So in terms of the individual, where is it? Here you go. No, I'll say, you know, knowing where to look is just as important, if not more important than when, sorry, knowing where to look is probably, if not as more important than understanding when to look and what to look for, right? Which, because fundamentally that will dictate the decision and the intention of the 1v1, in my opinion, in that if I see a specific body structure or body position or angle of approach from you as a defender, that will give me what I need as a source of information for me to guide my intention in that 1v1 moment. Does that make sense?
Yeah, of course. I mean, everything's based on information. So what are they looking for? What are they having to do? I mean, I know that we talked about this even before with the capabilities, whether it be timing, movement, positioning, so forth. It's all information, isn't it? There's so many ways we could probably look at this with the 1v1, because there's the moments where you're looking for information to optimally grip on info within the environment, whether it's the orientation of the defender, whether it's where your teammates are, space in front of you, whatever it may be, to come up with those solutions. But what about, I mean, with 1v1, we're talking about on ball. What about receiving in a 1v1? Because again, there's layers, isn't there? Are you dealing with pressure around? Are you dealing with pressure faced up? Are you dealing with pressure from behind, which most of the game is with pressure from behind? Are you dealing with pressure where you're in a 1v1, but again, it's not the first defender you got to worry about, it's the second. So there's almost like 1v2. So are you having to control the ball and protect it? So is it a protection touch or is it an elimination touch to beat a player? There's almost, we could go down as many different ways as possible really with this. And this is what I love about, if we were to put the 1v1 under a microscope of thinking about, right, what are the actual details of this? You could really talk about a lot of things. You could talk about receiving. You could talk about dribbling to beat a player 1v1. You could talk about, you know, finishing in a 1v1, defending in a 1v1. There's a lot, isn't there? There's a lot of different actions. So almost within each of those, there's even more details that you could go into. What experiences are we giving players? You know, if we're thinking about that 360 approach of every scenario that might occur within a 1v1, how are you designing environments that are going to help them get better at that? So I'm curious, you know, your thoughts on this, Yaz, in terms of what's the overall goal of trying to help our players get better at 1v1? Should it be that we're enlisting them in these environments where they're having to constantly make decisions on attacking, defending actions under changing experiences? That 360 approach where the 1v1 isn't the same, it's going to be different depending on each scenario. What's your thoughts?
I think you've hit the nail. But it's going to be dependent on each scenario. It's going to be different in each scenario, right? Because the thing is, so again, I'm just making notes as you're talking there, and it's just, well, the 1v1 is going to be one of two things. It's like I said, it's either going to be somewhat from an in possession perspective. It's either to finish it, like I said, effectively to finish the attack, or to support the team in retaining the ball effectively, right? Now, even then, the intention is led behind it. But actually, what the, you know, go back to the information piece, whether the defender's in front of me to the side of me, wherever they may appear in front of me and whatnot, is going to dictate what that looks like, right? Because then you've got to think about the journey of the 1v1 as an example. You might start off with, right, okay, Gerard's in front of me. If I beat Gerard with the intention of trying to finish the attack, actually, what's the next chapter in that story? Well, the next chapter in that story is I've beat Gerard, who's the fullback, but the centre-back steps out because he's the covering player. Okay, brilliant. So now it's a 1v1, moving into a 1v1 from being in front to a 1v1 to coming, maybe coming from the side, potentially, depending on how you go past the left-back, right? So I think it's looking at it that actually the constant angles are changing. So coming back to your question, if I've understood it correctly, in terms of where we focus the 1v1s and what the intention is there, it's fundamentally about getting the players to understand that, one, there's two sides of the story, i.e. the yin and yang of an in and out of possession in a 1v1 situation. So it's not always about what's happening on the ball. But actually, in some cases, it's not always about even starting with a ball. Okay, and it's something, you know, again, so many different angles we can kind of nail that one from as well. And the fact that, is it looking at, again, the technical components and the pairings of those things, are you receiving to dribble? Are you starting with the ball? Therefore, you're already dribbling. Therefore, there's no receive. So now you're dribbling to pass or dribbling to shoot. Those pairings, so to speak, will ultimately give you fundamentally different outcomes and, I guess, scenes in your story, right? Because that's what they are. They're effectively different scenes in your story. Your story is about, again, whether you're looking to be a player who's going to create attack, support the attack, or you're going to finish the attack, however you wish to look at it. Or on the flip side, you're going to be the defending player, in which case the 1v1 situation is just an understanding, right? Is this an isolated 1v1? Is it a 1v1 that's isolated that's going to potentially become a 1v2, right? Therefore, I now need to press and approach the ball in a certain way, or actually because it's a 1v1 situation, but actually I'm tracking a runner that might be looking at doing one of those component pairings. And therefore, I now need to support and defend in a different way based on that. So there's so many different angles we can go in. But I think the key for me is, are we helping the players understand what scene of the story they're in? Are they going from a pass to passing it to then running? Are they receiving to finish? Are they dribbling to finish? Are they dribbling to pass? Are they receiving to pass? So wherever those pairings come in, right, where does the player that they're playing up against in the 1v1 situation situate themselves within that scene of the story? Then also not just looking at it from a standpoint of numbers of players, but also recognizing if we go down, you know, the old step principle concept as well, even looking at distances, what's the distance? What does everyone constitute as a 1v1? Typically, you know, most people, when you ask them about this type of stuff, they're probably something within a 10-yard radius. But actually, what happens if you're a team that actually likes to sit back and you've got a 5-4-1 or a 5-3-2 shape going on, and then you've got your fullback on the opposite end of the pitch on a 4-4-2? Actually, that 1v1 situation out wide might be very, very large and very big. Right, so it's just looking at the distances involved and the complexities that then combine those distances with the intention, with the intended component pairings that are within it from an out-of-possession perspective, and then understanding, are we going from creating the attack, are we looking to kind of support the attack, or are we looking to finish the attack? There's a lot in there. My mind's just gone on a bit of a kind of a wild goose chase a little bit, but I'm just trying to articulate it as best as I can. I don't know if that helps.
Yeah, it does, because it actually got me thinking about, you probably obviously know Callum Martin, who's with England now with the youth squads, right? I think he's been assisting leading with the 15s and 16s, previously with Southampton and Fulham. He actually did his own little study a couple of years ago on 1v1s, and it was during the time of the Euros. And again, he came up with some of these challenging things, which you've just described, which was that, you know, it depends on the clarity of how you define that 1v1 in what area. But even just looking at the average number of 1v1s, I mean, I remember from his study, he looked at the group games, each group, right, the number of 1v1s that occurred in every match within the Euros, right up to the final. And there was a lot of 1v1s every game. I mean, in the final itself, England v Italy, which went to extra time, by his calculations, had over 74 1v1s in it. Now, it changed depending on positions, because each game is different, the context is different, right? But the majority of the 1v1s came from wide players, whether it be a 7 or 11, and centre-forwards. Centre-backs actually had the fewest in his numbers when he looked at it at the top level. Full-backs, holding midfielders, they typically had more as well. But then the type of pressure, that clarity is different, right? So if you think about position, the type of pressure, it's difficult to distinguish between the difference of what do we mean by behind, around, to the side, etc. Because within a matter of seconds, milliseconds, it can change, can't it? You know, in some cases, you could face all three types of pressure in a matter of seconds. But most of the pressure, which align with his study and his own independent study, but then also what's been presented by UEFA in some technical reports and just from Champions League, is that most pressure comes from behind or around. So then there's a stat there that suggests, well, does that relate to your practices? Do your practices reinforce those type of experiences? And then obviously it's different based on the position, because, you know, if you're centre forward, you might get more pressure that's behind, and then only limited amount of pressures to the side. You know, it'll vary based on position specific. And then I think, where does it occur on the field? Now, a lot of that will depend on the opposition you're playing, right? Because some opponents will allow you to have possession of the ball in some areas of the field and others won't. So they'll contest certain spaces, and that'll be different game to game, depending on what their defensive structures and strategies are. But it's interesting, even when you look at the number of dribbles attempted it's significant across the game now at the top level. It's significantly decreased. There's not as many dribblers anymore. Is that because people are preferring players to pass the ball out of trouble? It's an interesting one. And is it becoming a lost skill? And when it does happen, it's of more importance. So, and then you've got to think, well, what areas of the field are those 1v1s occurring in? You know, and there's a lot of 1v1s that will occur, obviously, if you visualise, obviously, attacking in the opponent's half and probably towards the outside spaces compared to minimal inside. But again, depending if your team's a team that likes to build up and construct the attack, you used that phrase before, build the attack, well, there's a risk that you could be in a lot of 1v1s during that moment of the game and phase of the game. So I think it's powerful stuff. I mean, if we actually think about 1v1 as a curriculum, there's so much we could do to develop in players. I almost suggest that we've got to have a lens on this in thinking how are we developing our players to search for solutions, play with instinct, learn quickly but consistently, because there's two differences there, and be able to adapt and in these type of situations, because every 1v1 is nuanced and it's going to require different types of skills. I mean, it's funny, when I was at I always remember being at Rochdale, an incredible environment, really good academy. I remember encouraging dribbling, and even in other clubs I've worked in, not frowned upon is maybe a harsh word, but it certainly wasn't a skill that was encouraged. We were often, the bias was, you know, we want to pass the ball. And I think that's interesting, because then when you look at the game now and how it's played, is that as a result of this? You know, where, of course, when players do dribble and they drive at players, we find it so entertaining, don't we? But it's occurring less and less. So is there a duty there that, as coaches, we need to think about building this curriculum where we're encouraging players to dribble and take people on, play with instinct? You know, what does that look like? I mean, there's so much, isn't there, whether you're thinking about your mastery and your manipulation of the ball, controlling surfaces. There's a lot that could go into it. But if you were to spend time really going into the 1v1 detail of playing with pressure at different areas of the, you know, different scenarios, and creating these little activities where players are in a 1v1, but do they have to beat a player to go to an end zone, or is it to beat a player to play into a target? Because that's, you know, we want to find that free player forward, or is it drive across players, like run across players, which is so difficult to defend against? You know, there's so much we could talk about, but ultimately, what I'm saying is that, you know, there's a real importance here that there's certain skills that are almost going out of the game that we've probably got a duty of care to try and bring back into the game.
Yeah, I think, you know, one thought that comes to mind on that is just obviously, you know, just going back to the idea of knowing what's coming next for your players. You know, what's the future game look like? You know, obviously these are all kind of things that we know, if we're going to have a crystal ball that tells us exactly what it looks like. But I think definitely what we do now will dictate what they're going to be able to do in 2 or 3 or however many years' time, right? But even coming back to the piece around problem solving and finding solutions, ultimately, you know, my kind of really challenge to coaches in this moment would be, well, the game is full of problems anyway. So don't get lost in the source in terms of the game as the teacher, because the game has got the capacity to give you some problems to deal with. But the question is, are those the problems that you are intentionally going after as coaches, right? So really what I'm asking coaches to think about is, what problems do you actually want your players to solve? And it got me thinking about this phrase, as someone said to me, it's literally up there, I thought, you know what, you're spot on. And they said, right is right. Right is right, meaning, well, if they found a way that works, then it's right, isn't it? As long as you give them an idea of what the problem is that you're trying to solve, and not just leaving them to find out what problems there are, because I think that's where you can get diluted a little bit. And it's just like, well, what problems did you find today? And yeah, we want to understand the problems that they found, but we also want to be intentional about the problems that we set, not because we're trying to teach them specific problems. But we want to be clear on what it is that we're attacking as the theme of the day, if that makes sense. Now, if it is a case that you want them to identify a problem first, and how much effort and how much intention is going into around unpacking the problem that they've highlighted for you. And I think it's a bit of a double-edged sword sometimes, because as coaches coming into the game now, you might not always have that game knowledge, the game understanding yourself to really unpack every type of problem that your players are encountered. Whereas if you can start with, and if that is the end of the spectrum that you're on in terms of your journey, then you can start by directing what the problems are that you're going to go after, before you start giving a bit more autonomy to your players to kind of help you understand what problems they see and face. And then the flip side of that is, you know, something, another word that you used there as well, is about adapt. Well, part of the idea of developing more skillful players and, you know, developing players who are more effective in making decisions is actually getting them to be able to adapt and getting them to recognize how to adapt and when to adapt and what they're adapting to. So a large part of this for me is around checking understanding. So even if you go back to the idea of the 1v1 itself, well, what's your 1v1? What is the pairing that you're giving them? What are the trade-offs for? Like, for instance, if you put in a practice which has no goal in it, then you're not going to have a pairing that links itself to finishing. You might just have a pairing that links itself to a dribble or a pass. And that's about it, which is fine. It's not a problem, but it's you understanding what the parameters of the 1v1 that you're working with at that given moment. And then it gets me thinking about, well, again, another thing that you mentioned there, how much does that get mimicked, if you like, within your practice design, within your practice environment? How often are you working on those things? Do your players understand the difference between a 1v1 to finish the attack and a 1v1 to help create one, right? As opposed to thinking every 1v1's for the same intention. Because I think if we can help the players to understand that, you know what, the intention of today's 1v1 is to find ways to create attacks, and that be the focus, I think you'd see a very, very different outcome. And then just building on that, I think to myself, well, if you've got the 1v1 situation and you have an understanding of what the intention is because of the situation you're in, i.e. where it's on the pitch, who the opposition is, and actually developing a better understanding of who the opposition is in the moment and what your capabilities are as an individual, then that might help you and support you as an individual player in particular in understanding what the intention of the 1v1 should be in this moment. Knowing what your super strength is, essentially, knowing what the weakness of the opposition may or may not be, but knowing also the capabilities of those around you. So I think it always brings me back to this idea that 1v1, and you know, people talk about there being so many different 1v1s across the pitch all the time. There is, but some of them are on the ball, some of them are off the ball, but actually all of them are either involved in building or creating that attack or finishing the attack, in fact. And the question is, do your players understand what moment they're in and what the moment that if they're not directly on the ball, what moment they're supporting, what moment their 1v1 is supporting as another 1v1, if that makes sense. I don't know what your thoughts are on that, Joe, if that last bit even made sense, but it would be good for you to clarify.
I think it's just tying everything back to moments, isn't it? So moments and principles that we're going after. So just in simplicity, if we've got a situation, a game scenario that we're trying to recreate, we're trying to make it as representative as possible, thinking about the field, pitch geography, the moment in the game, the principle, then you're looking at the nuanced details of the individual player actions that we're looking at reinforcing, and then again, those individual tactics. And it just... Do you know what it really makes me think about is that you could spend a whole season on 1v1s and you wouldn't have done any harm. Like, the players will still benefit from it. You could spend a whole season working on building to play forward. You could spend often, I think a lot of people's session yearly plans, if you like. They're bouncing around here, there, and everywhere and trying to cover a lot of different topics. But actually, if you really to go into detail, you could spend a lot of time on a lot of these topics and really still benefit the players individually. That's what's a striking thing for me is, yes, the one that we need to have this connection to the game and to match prep and so that we understand the team concepts. But actually, you could develop a lot of really, I actually want to use the word as a compliment, basic, but not as a negative, simplistic activities that are simple, but actually they're globally benefiting. And we probably try to overcomplicate everything, but actually there's a room for that, isn't there? So this is good stuff, good conversations. I don't know. Tony, I just saw your message now. Thanks for that. I don't know if Tony wants to add on to anything or anyone else in the room, if they want to share their thoughts, you know, or what they're thinking.
Yeah, just an additional thought for me as you're speaking is, we also can't forget that part of the 1v1 is teaching the principles of play. Right? It can be done in the 1v1 moment. I think not all the principles can necessarily come out in the 1v1 situation or the 1v1 elements, but actually coaching the principles. I think that comes back to it as well, is what are we trying to do? Are we in position? Are we out of position? Are we trying to penetrate or are we trying to support? Are we trying to press or are we trying to cover? Are we, you know, those different things. And I think having the ability to maybe take a step back sometimes and dissect the pitch in so many ways where it can be right. Where is the 1v1 taking place? Is it based on positional aspects of where the people are situated, based on their team shape? Is it based on the individuals and maybe how they might be better suited to kind of pair up with someone else? Is it based on actually the transitional moments of going in from 1v1 over here to 1v1 over there, because actually we're in a transition, so now I'm having to change roles and move from being in this 1v1 to another 1v1. Does that make sense?
Yeah, for sure.
Baseball fans, BetMGM is giving you the chance to win a prize every day during the baseball season. Step into the batter's box for BetMGM's Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. Pick any area of the strike zone and take your best swing. If you get a single, double, triple, or home run, you'll receive a prize. Smash a home run to collect a bonus bet on us. Just log into your BetMGM sports account to get started. Then visit your promotion section to access the Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. You'll score a prize if you hit a single, double, triple, or home run. There's nothing more exciting than going yard, so swing for the fences with the king of sportsbooks. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. Must be 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards vary depending on the market and expire 24 hours from issuance. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Prime Day es el 16 y 17 de julio. Con las ofertas épicas exclusivas para miembros Prime, recibe el reconocimiento que tanto mereces.
¡Wow! Gracias. Ni siquiera preparé un discurso.
Quisiera agradecer a mi familia, que siempre necesita cosas. También a Sam, mi repartidor, por entregarme todas mis ofertas increíbles tan rápido. ¡Te adoro, Sam! ¡Mua!
Compra ofertas en electrónicos, hogar y más este Prime Day, del 16 al 17 de julio.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So I mean, there's probably a lot of questions at this point in terms of people thinking. I know, obviously, on the space, it's not always the best place to kind of share questions because a lot of people don't want to pick up the mic, which is fine. But sure, you know, I have a question I'll throw at you is, if you were thinking about you know, building on what you said about starting a curriculum focused around 1v1s, where would you start with that?
Great question. And we've actually implemented some stuff already in probably the past 2-3 roles that I've been in. So starting place was, obviously we did some background data, but we just simplified it and looked at different types of pressure. And then how can you create, whether it's a circuit practice or 1v1 activities where there's target players at either end and target players can move. So that way you're focusing on the 1v1 where the ball's getting played in from somewhere. And as it's getting played in, that means the ball's traveling, which means you're having to receive whilst already under pressure. So you're arriving and getting the, and obviously there's a trigger for the defender as well to recognize, well, do I travel as the ball travels? Can I travel? Can I press? Can I intercept? If I can't do all those things, do I apply pressure after the first touch? Do I delay? What do I do? So really just creating lots of different activities. And this is my point earlier, is that you said it yourself, you're working on principles. Well, you could do that same 1v1 activity, but you could spin it for defending or attacking, right? So everything's coupled. And I think that's the benefit. We've also, and where I would start as well, is thinking about how we can embed competition within the activity. So often think about the matchups. So when you're designing your small-sided games or your medium-sized games or your attack B defenses, and you've got your shape, you've got your sort of structure, if you like, of who's the forwards, who's the midfielders, who's the defenders, what does it look like? Have a think about what those matchups look like. So have you got a certain player against a certain player? You know, are the centre-backs only marking one centre-forward, or are they having to deal with two? Do the outside defenders, the full-backs, the two and the three, do they have to deal with wingers? Or do they have to deal with wingers and somebody else? What are the matchups in midfield? What's the matchups in building the ball? So those matchups are important because you're creating immediate competition, a direct opponent against somebody. And do you have grids? Do you have grids that are restrictive? Or do you have grids that are not restrictive, but they're there as a visual? So perhaps there's certain rules that you induce upon the practice so that it creates more type of 1v1 scenarios. Is it as simple as, like, if the ball arrives in this zone, there can only be no more than two players, but you can't be in the same zone as a teammate? So it forces your team to have to receive in different types of boxes, but when they do so, they're under pressure. Or is it as simple as you're playing a game, but if the ball goes out of play, or when the ball goes to an outside player, it must be a 1v1. So that's a way of developing, right? How many times have people had neutral players or servers, wide players that they use that aren't really pressurized to as an extra player within a practice? Well, what if the ball travels to that player? Can they be closed down? You know, or is it as simple as, I mentioned this on one of the previous spaces, where you've got a game, one team goes 1-0 up, they immediately go into a 1v1. So keep ball to see which team has all the balls by the end of the 10-second period. At the end of the 10 seconds, if every player on the same team that scored has a ball, the goal stands and it's 1-0 up. If one of the players has lost their ball, it's the goal doesn't stand. Ball back in the middle and play. So you create little games within games, you know. And again, there's 1,000 different 1v1 type activities that you could do. And I think the beauty of it is you can make it as general or specific as you like. Because the more specific you go, you're talking more positional, right? And pitch, field geography, specific and the context, which has a place. But equally, you can still do a lot of sort of general global activities that could be done anywhere on the field, but they're still getting those sort of individual tactics, if you like, and movement solutions. You know, do a different shape. So where we started, we looked at, and this was the sort of start of coaches experimenting with different activity designs. So even in my recent club, I gave everyone a, a challenge during the winter to think about different ways that we can develop the 1v1. And knowing that you've got, you know, 10 players, 12 players, 15 players, 20 players, however many you've got within your training session, how would you utilize space? And as an example, one of the guys, they did a, it's hard to do it over Twitter space, but if you can imagine a little diamond. So instead of a square or rectangle, imagine a diamond as a coned area, practice space. So you've got a shape of a diamond. In the middle of that diamond was a 1v1. And on the outsides of the space was players that could be passed to or could bounce the ball in. But they have to change. They can't be on the same angle. Now, because it's a diamond, there should no really... You always have to be on an angle because of the rule. So there's no like vertical pass, if you like. There's a vertical, but it's always on an angle. It's not square. So there's no one at either apex. You're either on the... You're basically on the sides. And players can change their angle. But when the ball's played into one of the players in the middle and it's 1v1, their job is they've got to stay on the ball and find a way to beat the player before they can release it to the opposite end or play back. But if they play back to the person that served it in, they have to get it back off him again as well. So like just those little rules. And again, you can manipulate the rules however you want, but there's always consequences, good and bad, for those little rules, right? Because the rules will then force how you attack and how you defend. As a constraint, it's emphasizing and amplifying certain situations. And then we did little challenges. Now, we found that the diamond shape, similar to when you do like circles and other shapes, it afforded different types of angles and different types of movements than it would just going with a regular square or just a box or whatever. So I think that's where I would start, is go beyond like the classical 1v1, I pass the ball to Yaz, we're facing each other, we're faced up, and I close him down. That's okay, but go beyond that. Try to create it in a game where I've got pressure immediately within that area. How do I lose a marker? How do I get on the ball when I've got somebody coming at me? What do I do? And even manipulate where the goals are. So like manipulating targets. I mean, we did a 1v1 where we thought one of the guys, it was quite clever, just work on like the number nine's movement. So the number nine would start in an offside position to come onside. One of the midfielders is playing the ball in, but they would make that run off the centre half to get the ball. So the run to come short. Now they're at the player and they've got to beat the defender to score in a goal with a keeper. That 1v1 was technically, it's a 1v2 if you include the keeper. So there's so much that you could do, but are those tactics that you need all over the field? Absolutely. You know, we just built like a load of sessions, like different activities. Again, I encourage anyone to try this one. I'm spitballing loads of ideas at once here as I'm on a ramble. Have you ever done this, Yaz, where you've done a knock the ball off the cone? So you put a ball on the cone and you got to knock it off with a pass.
I've seen it done. I'll be honest, I don't really do it, but yeah. So funny, I was watching it earlier on, someone doing it, and I was thinking to myself, I would never do that, but go on.
Well, I like it. I like it because I've done games where it's possessional, so it's working on the pass, or I've done it where the ball on the cone is a target, right? So you're a 1v1 in the middle, but you've got to beat the player and you've got to pass it by knocking the ball off the cone. So my question is, why couldn't you do it, right? So, or even the best one I saw was someone defending a water bottle. So imagine you tell the kids to come to practice and bring a water bottle. But the object is you take the lid off and I've got to beat Yaz 1v1 and smack the ball against the bottle. The first person to knock all the person's water out wins. I'm telling you, the defending goes through the roof. Players defend for their life because it's a visual as well. It's like, oh, and you're running over and you're picking the water bottle up and there's a little bit of water left in. And then he's trying to beat him and then you're knocking it and you just miss or you knock his bottle over. And then his water goes down, he's sprinting. The 1v1, the pressure's heightened. It's no different to knocking a ball off a cone. You can manipulate the location of that. So you can use any teaching techniques and strategies you want to create the environment that you want, right? And that's where I would go with it, is trying to create as much fun, as much playful nature, and as much competition. Because, you know, I've just shared a load of examples there where with minimal equipment, you could create it. It doesn't have to be a 1v1. We're lucky at Sporting. We're spoiled. We've got goals galore, equipment, you name it. But actually, going back to basics, water bottles and knocking a water bottle, you know, how cool is that? Or a ball off a cone or something. You know, it's something different that could elicit certain behaviours from a player. So that's where I would start.
I think there's a lot in there. I think the key thing I'll take out from what you've just said there is that it goes back to that phrase, right? Right is right. If you're finding a way to engage your players and get the intended actions out of the practice, then so be it. And you know, you're never going to make everyone happy with how you deliver it. So I think that's the beauty of these conversations. We've all got different ways of doing things. I think it's just understanding why we're doing it, and you know, it's just. Yeah, working with different ways. But I'm conscious we've got a couple of people that put their hands up to kind of speak as well. So, Jay, we'll start with you. Good evening. How are you?
Hi, good evening, guys. My name is Ethan. thanks for speaking this evening, guys. I just had a quick opinion. What do you think of, let's say I designed two 1v1 practices in one. What would your opinion of that be? I'll give an example. I'd set up a practice where a 1v1 occurs, maybe in the attacking third, and the objective would have been to get the ball into another 1v1 situation out wide, to then create to continue the attack. I'm just putting it out there. What would your opinion of that be? Sort of having two 1v1s in one practice.
Just to be clear there, Ethan, are you saying that you've got one 1v1 practice which is running and the other one's effectively waiting for the ball to come into the practice from the initial one? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, even though we don't necessarily want that, yeah. What would your opinion of that be still?
Well, I think there's a couple of different thoughts that have come running through my head straight away, and one is what's the purpose of the initial 1v1 in terms of context? Obviously, you said one's out wide and one's not, essentially. But I think it's less so about having them as separate things, because fundamentally they are, but it's actually understanding the importance of making sure the players are aware of how they link, rather than it just being two isolated 1v1 situations, but just saying, okay, you're going to connect with the pass of a ball. If that makes sense, because from that perspective, there could be any two 1v1 situations taking place across any part of the pitch. In which case, then you know the argument from myself would be, well, how do you get the transference of that into the game and the relevance of it in match day, right? So those are my initial thoughts, but I think I don't think there's anything necessarily wrong with the idea of putting a couple different 1v1 practices alongside each other. But if they are dependent on one being complete to kind of get the next one rolling, if you like, I would challenge why that would be the case. But also, if that is this way in which you're going to go about it, it's not a problem necessarily, as long as the players understand that there's a clear link from one situation to the next and how it develops. But then again, the only reservation I may have beyond that would be, how does that necessarily paint the picture of and align itself to the principles of play within the game's context? Those are my initial thoughts. I don't know if they make full sense, but Jared, any thoughts from you on that?
Yeah, obviously it's hard without seeing an image. Excuse me, but I don't necessarily dismind it, because ultimately, you know, you could either create a game in which there's going to be a lot of different 1v1s that will occur, right? And you could add different rules. You could have different rules and rewards to incentivize more 1v1s within that game. And as the ball moves to different areas, of course, there's going to be more 1v1 occurring. Or you could do, if I've understood you correctly, about the ball starts in this area and goes to another. Yeah. That's fine as well. The time constraint you're going to have to think about is obviously how you make sure it's realistic, or not even realistic. I hate that word sometimes. Just in engaging, challenging. Because yeah, if it takes too long, do you know what I mean? You may have to put a time constraint on it where, hey, you're receiving this ball and you're my number six. And I'm looking for you to quickly find the seven. So how quickly can we find that player? How quickly can we attack a wide space? Once that ball arrives into the wide space, now he's in that 1v1. What does he do? And maybe that's your format of the game. You're working. That's fine. Completely fine. I don't think there's any issue.
Just from what both of you have said, I'm just thinking like two ways I could tweak that idea would be if I'm not going to have multiple 1v1s sort of cascading, it would be whenever I do a 1v1 practice, it would be to sort of manipulate the outcome, whether it is a shot at the end of it or a pass. And the other, what is what you just finished saying about timing the practices. So like you said, if the first one takes too long, then you would probably say, can you get the ball into this area within 6 seconds of the 1v1? And that will sort of, bring up the intensity and hopefully the success.
It could do. Absolutely. I mean, it's a big question I've got for you before Yaz jumps in is, or anyone in the room, is have a definition for what success looks like.
Definitely.
I think that's where often a lot of these guys go wrong. And I've been guilty of it as well. Like, I'll come up with a rule or an activity, but then, and I'll say, hey, I'm working on this principle, but what does success look like? So if the definition of success to you is that, as that ball arrives in that 1v1, the successful outcome is it leads to a shot. Well, then you can measure that quantitatively, right, in your reflections with how many shots came from a player beating a player 1v1 to score.
Yeah,
you could also incentivize it. You could say, hey, if you score normally through normal play, it's worth one. But if you can beat your player, your opponent 1v1 that leads to a shot on goal, it's worth three or whatever it may be.
Yeah.
You know, and again, you could count the number of times where there's a player that was in a 1v1 and twisted and turned or just dribbled past him and got a shot off. But maybe that's not your definition for success. Maybe your definition of success is when they're in a 1v1, can they quickly beat the player? Now, that might not always be up, you know, on to do so. So then it's, are you okay with that? Because now you're going to get less attempts, but you might get some successes within that. Or it might be when they're in a 1v1, can they quickly find a friend? So it starts in a 1v1, but it becomes a 2v1. Again, there's so many. My point being is that having a clear definition of success is key. I do this all the time with, you know, a session I had the other day where one of the guys said, hey, we're breaking lines. Okay, but what does line breaking mean to you? And he said, well, when a ball passes, goes past a defensive unit, like a defender. I said, how many? Is it one? Is it two? He said, well, for him, it was when it goes past two or more defenders, that's going to be successful. I said, okay, so it has to be at least two of the opposition's defenders. It breaks a line. Are you looking at through, around, or over? Anyway, okay. What's the outcome, though? Is it because he had counter goals? So does it only count as a success if it leads into a ball that goes in the counter goal, or are you still measuring success if we break a line? And he was like, oh, you got me now. And again, it opens up a debate, doesn't it? A question. So what does success look like for you in the practice? So, I'll leave you with that one.
Yeah. Thanks, Gerard.
Just on that really quickly, I think it's another key thing to kind of touch on. It's, I'm always conscious about putting time constraints on practices, you know, whether it be 5 seconds, 6 seconds, 10 seconds, because the thing that always comes back to my mind is, well, how long would it take for that action to be achieved in a game? In 6 seconds in a game, what would actually happen? In 5 seconds in a game, what would actually happen? Well, depending on the level, age, and stage of the players, you might get a whole team back in position by the time you get the 5 seconds up. So I think it's, again, it's been very consciously clear about what is the intention of the 1v1, what are you hoping to achieve within it, why are you hoping to achieve that in it, where does that link itself back to the game of the players? So just a few thoughts to think about in the process of that. But I'm conscious, Emmanuel, you got your hand up on that as well. And did you have something you wanted to add to this specific piece before you brought it into yours?
Thank you again. Some great discussions. I just wanted to share something that I spoke with a colleague of mine probably a few months ago, and we were talking about 1v1s, and I think it was something that you must have seen somewhere, and it was around sort of the intention of 1v1 is to highlight the I within that moment. So I think it was around what can I do in this moment, whether that's attacking, defending. And then you're moving on to then, you know, me and you, and then us, but really shining a light on that sort of moment. And I think just from listening to the discussions in here, it goes back to the game yesterday, the final, and when Jeremy Doku came on. And it's looking at it from both spectrums in terms of Wan-Bissaka defending that I moment within that 1v1 situation. And Jeremy Doku's goal is refining and shining a light on either it might be a super strength that player's got, or maybe an area of development for them to get better at. But it's like that, I don't know if everyone's aware of that move that Jeremy Doku does, sort of off balance the defender and exploit the space that's opened. It might be within that moment you're refining a shift and shoot technique, where you're finding the right moment to off-balance the defender to then create that space to shoot, but you're really focusing on the eye. And then as, you know, as time goes on, you start adding the me and you. So it's now, right, this is what I'm good at in this situation, whether that's attacking, defending. And now others are recognising, right, this is what we can do in this situation. So I think it's really important to shine a light on that eye within the 1v1 situations.
I think it's a great point, Emmanuel, and I think it links perfectly into the piece that me and Jared are going to cover, obviously, on our webinar, where we talk about a case study on Arjen Robben. Very much that is, you know, what am I capable of? What are you capable of? And I think those are so important in terms of understanding the 1v1 situation. So I really appreciate that. I'm conscious, obviously, you know, you came up before Ethan actually brought on any of what he said. So, what, you know, what was the initial things that you were going to bring up?
It was just in regards to that. I was just having to think as the conversations have been going on, and I was just thinking about how we can really be specific within these moments. If it is a 1v1 practice that we're doing, just shining a light on that eye moment and ensuring that. I think going back to some of the discussions, it was around, is there enough dribbling within, you know, like sort of youth football? And helping those players, because I think sometimes there isn't enough dribbling, because dribbling can unlock so many things. That you dribble into entice pressure, you dribble into then play a pass to then make another forward run. But encouraging the players and shining the light on that specific eye moment, so then they can get the fundamental details right, which then they naturally can decide to, they develop other parts of the game as well, when to release it, when to do this, when to do that. But just help them in that situation.
Awesome. No, I think you're spot on. I think it is just, you know, really unpacking it. I think there's so much detail that goes into it, right? And I think this is the key bit that, you know, that comes from the back of these conversations, where everyone approaches it from different angles and different perspectives. And it's just, there is no one right way. It's just, you know, sharing ideas. And I really appreciate your thoughts on that, Emmanuel. Gerard, I don't know if there's any final thoughts from you as well before we look to wrap up. Or if anyone has any other questions that they want to share and I guess get an insight on, and, you know, obviously we're here for that as well.
Just really echoing Emmanuel's points, you know, I think, and the data is actually there. There's so much power that can come from dribbling to engage an opponent, isn't there? Or manipulating the ball, staying on the ball, which can open a passing lane. It's not always available to pass. You might have to stay with the ball and carry the ball, which again is an important skill, or drive an opponent that creates something somewhere else. And I'd say there's probably a a heightened responsibility now because we're seeing fewer and fewer of these cases actually happen. And again, the ones that are attempting it, even at the top level, the more they're unsuccessful. There's a lot of unsuccessful stats with dribbling. So I think that probably leads a question of, well, how can we design even better environments where we're encouraging our players to be able to retain possession? That's why when you mentioned the 1v1, right, just to go full circle to the beginning, I think one of my first answers was to keep the ball as well as to advance the ball, right, in a 1v1 when I was thinking purely on in possession, when I've even spoken about out of possession. So that's a just to build on Emmanuel's points really there is, again, something that people can go away and have a play with. And, you know, the quality of our questions represents the quality of our value. So if we're posing questions to players or certain incentives within a practice that rewards passing over dribbling, you got to be aware of those biases. I'm not saying that's right or wrong. There's times where to incentivize that is key, but maybe there's also an advantage to incentivizing some other things as well.
Most definitely. Guys, just to follow up on what Gerard said then, obviously just to kind of remind everyone, this is an FA accredited CPD. Just a quick reminder around kind of the small print, if you like. You'll only be eligible for a CPD if you've completed the post-reflection survey, a post-discussion reflection survey, which just takes literally 2-3 minutes out of your time at most. And just for clarity's sake, you can only be accredited for any of the CPD sessions that we've done, provided you've completed that reflection survey within the same calendar month of the CPD session. Regarding time frames, timelines, at the back end of that month, whichever calendar month it falls into, it will take about 4 to 6 weeks at the end of that calendar month, which is when we submit the hours in. It takes 4 to 6 weeks for you to get updated. So if you did something at the start of the month, unfortunately, you have to wait until the end of the month for it to get submitted, and at which point it'll take another 4 to 6 weeks to get updated onto your CPD, your fan numbers. So just bear that in mind when you're getting in touch if you're trying to follow up on some of the CPD hours that have been logged already. And obviously, this conversation is as part of a series of spaces that we've been running as part of a series that we've been doing on the 360 approach to 1v1 situation. So as a result of following, obviously, the three spaces, we often finish off with a webinar. So we will be having a webinar. Initially, the plan was to have that webinar this Thursday, the 30th of May. But we're going to be pushing that back 2 weeks. So that will be, I believe, what day would that be, Gerard? 13th of May, 13th of June, isn't it? So 13th of June is hopefully when we're going to be pushing that webinar back to. So I'll send out a link shortly in which you can kind of get access to that as well. Just remember, guys, obviously you might honestly have to be live on the webinar as well to gain CPD hours for that. So if you have already got a ticket for that, or you're thinking about joining it and you're not able to make the live session, you can still gain CPD hours off the back of completing that, in which case you'll be given access post the initial date and time to attend and review the recording of the webinar. Gerard, I don't know if there's anything I've missed before we sign off.
No, that's perfect. I'm going to share a link with everyone. And again, these have been really well engaged. You know, we've had so many people respond and gain some CPD from it. But more importantly, I think it's the community that we've got, you know, all of us in this community, just being curious, not judgmental, and constantly asking questions. So I appreciate everyone that's, you know, that's coming in to listen in to these conversations and contributing, because it's just helping us all get better, which is awesome. So I'll share a link to the reflection, and then, you know, really looking forward to the webinar in the next couple of weeks.
Awesome. Just a final reminder, guys, is it FA Credit CPD? You can access that through the link that Gerald's going to share. But also, if you've missed a live conversation here on X or Twitter, as it's formerly known, you can catch it on the Coaches Network podcast, where it's uploaded on the Wednesday following the session. And just make sure you're following us, guys. We've always got new content coming out, always got new discussions taking place. If there's anything that you particularly want to have discussed or heard on the space session, do let us know. We're here to continue building the community, continue growing these conversations, and making sure everyone gets better at this coaching thing. So enjoy your evening, guys. Take care. Until next week, have a great week.
Well, there you have it, guys. Another episode of the Coaches Network podcast, where our aim is to bring the world of athlete, talent, and personal development together to just one platform. And you can help us with that mission right now by sharing this episode or any of your favorite episodes with everyone that you can think of. You can tag us in those mentions as well on Instagram at the Coaches Network or on Twitter at the Coaches Net. We look forward to hearing from you. Let us know what you thought about today's episode. And until next time, guys, take care.
Baseball fans, BetMGM is giving you the chance to win a prize every day during the baseball season. Step into the batter's box for BetMGM's Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. Pick any area of the strike zone and take your best swing. If you get a single, double, triple, or home run, you'll receive a prize. Smash a home run to collect a bonus bet on us. Just log into your BetMGM Sports account to get started. Then visit your promotion section to access the Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. You'll score a prize if you hit a single, double, triple, or home run. There's nothing more exciting than going yard, so swing for the fences with the king of sportsbooks. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. Must be 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards vary depending on the market and expire 24 hours from issuance. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Prime Day es el 16 y 17 de julio. Con las ofertas épicas exclusivas para miembros Prime, recibe el reconocimiento que tanto mereces.
¡Wow! Gracias. Ni siquiera preparé un discurso.
Quisiera agradecer a mi familia, que siempre necesita cosas. También a Sam, mi repartidor, por entregarme todas mis ofertas increíbles tan rápido. ¡Te adoro, Sam! ¡Mua!
Compra ofertas en electrónicos, hogar y más este Prime Day, del 16 al 17 de julio.